right. So today's a little bit of a different podcast. Today we just have a one camera setup. This is a setup that we use in our podcast studio. This is a setup that we use for our live events in our community. So we thought that we would do kind of a combo, a live event recording that goes into the community, but also one that we put on YouTube as a podcast episode.
Yeah, so our community is Progress Your Hormones Community, and we have a really lovely group of women from all over the world. And we come together kind of more in a private, safe space where we can talk all about hormones, women's health, longevity, you name it, you think it. So right now, we're actually recording this for our community that we're going to put in our recording so that our community members can watch it. But for this event, we're actually going to be able to let you watch it on YouTube.
Yeah, now this one is what we call a hormonal hot seat. So we're going to put you in the hormonal hot seat. Now, excuse me. So you did blood work back in January, which we have already discussed in the community, and you just had some blood work done. It looks like it was September 4th.
Yeah, technically last week from what is today, the 11th, September 11th.
Today's September
So
11th.
we wanted to kind of compare that. I did the hormone blood work, and then I also did cholesterol and a few other things. So I thought we could go over that and just some parameters, not just for hormones for women, but also testing that you can do as females, so we can look at longevity, because there's lots of other testing besides just looking at your white blood cells and your red blood cells. So we'll kind of go into that so you can get an idea of some testing that might be really nice for females and also what the reference ranges mean.
Yeah, now do you want to go through your January one first so you can see the before and after?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Let's do that. And it's not really a before and after per se, but let's start with that one because that's a little more basic. And then we go into a little bit more specifics.
So bear
So
with
the camera is sharing the screen.
me. Not yet. So bear
Okay.
with me while we get it all set up. I gotta make sure to keep my mouth in front of the camera here.
Or in
Or
front of,
the
yeah, the mic.
microphone. Right. This is the January one. Okay, so now you're going to be able to see the screen. So this is pretty standard, right? This is just a labs that everybody does, just a CBC, complete blood count, looking at white blood cells, red blood cells. Everything's perfect.
Yeah, so the white blood cells, 5.9, that looks good. You break up the white blood cells into neutrophils, lymphocytes, monocytes, eosinophils, and basophils, and also platelets. Platelets are part of your clotting factors, so you don't want to have too many platelets because then your blood's kind of sticky, and then you don't want to have too little because then your blood would be thin. So they're at 221, that's pretty good. The neutrophils, lymphocytes, monocytes, eosinophils, and basophils, that also encompasses the white blood cells, but they're more like your soldiers. They come out when they're fighting, whether it's a viral infection or a bacterial infection. The eosinophils are a little bit more about allergies. So if that was elevated, that could be seasonal allergies or food allergies. The neutrophils are a little bit more about viruses, maybe your simple cold or just the crud people get every once in a while. And then the monocytes turn into macrophages, which are like the tanks. And that's when somebody, if that's elevated, that's when somebody really has more of a bacterial infection. Same with the, so then you have the red blood cells. So in females, I always like to check to make sure that they're not anemic, that they don't have too low red blood cells, which is the hemoglobin and the hematocrit, which is in the red blood cell, which consists of telling you what sort of like your iron is. So if somebody has a low hemoglobin hematocrit, that could be due to dietary, and then they're having low iron, or if they have low red blood cells, they might be losing too many red blood cells, possibly in their period or whatnot. So that could be part of that anemia. The MCV, the MCH, and the MCHC, that's the mean corpuscular volume, mean corpuscular hemoglobin, mean corpuscular hemoglobin
Did you have a lot
concentration.
of caffeine today?
No, I just, you guys
Yeah.
know me. If you've been watching me, I talk really fast. My mom's Asian, she talks fast. I've learned it from her. I talk fast. But those indices are looking at the morphology of your red blood cell, and you don't want it to be too chubby, because if that MCV is like over 100, that means there's some basically more like B12 deficiency, or if it's too small, that could be nutritional deficiency. So right there, that's a nice morphology. So, and I'm not bragging, but those are my indices.
Okay. All right. So that covers the CBC, pretty standard stuff, but it does tell you a lot, especially about nutritional status, iron, B vitamins,
Allergies,
allergies.
infections.
Lots of things there. So let's move on from that. This is now also very standard. This is a kind of a broken up comprehensive metabolic panel or a chem panel or a chem 14. very standard stuff. Doctors are doing these for, you know, yearly physicals, and if you run going to the emergency room, they're going to start with these kinds of stuff. It looks at, you know, generalized main body things that keep us alive: glucose, kidney function, liver function, electrolytes.
I will say my glucose is probably a little low there. I was fasting for about 14 hours, but and honestly, 73 is awesome. But sometimes when I see the glucose like in the 60s or that low 70s, you think, oh, maybe that person, which I know me, has a tendency towards being a little more hypoglycemic. So that's why I try to maintain, you know, maybe having a little snack every few hours. And then
I
the
think the 73 is a perfect number.
well, I appreciate
Yeah,
that.
that's a
I
perfect number.
appreciate that.
You don't have a reactive hypoglycemia.
No, but you know,
If
it's when
someone
you're
who does and they have a number like that or a 68,
you can put it together.
and they're symptomatic, that's a little deceptive. That number then is actually a little too low. It's like a rebound hypoglycemia. But you've never had, you know, at least that I've noticed, any like actual real, you know, that moment where
Hangry?
Hangry, where you need food right away. You've never really had that before.
One thing that I'm noticing there that maybe just for me, now that I'm in menopause, that you know, I have been trying to think about, you know, having protein snacks around, you know, making sure there's something to eat every few hours. I do notice if I don't eat for a long time, I do kind of get a little more tired. Or if I don't drink enough water and I'm working a lot and forget to eat, I just kind of get tired. Where if I maintain a little extra protein and hydration, I do seem to have a lot more energy throughout the day and the afternoon.
Yeah, but a glucose for everyone, you want it to be somewhere between 75 and 85. Once we start getting into the 90s and the upper 90s, even though it's still technically normal, quote unquote, that's when things are, you know, a blood sugar, fasting blood sugar of 98 or 97 is not normal.
I wouldn't say
So I
attainable.
think your number is actually very good.
I'd say in the 90s, it's not terrible, but it's something to take into consideration. And then we have the BUN, which is the blood urea nitrogen, the creatinine, and then the eGFR, which is the estimated glomerular filtration rate. So that's looking at your kidney function. So if somebody is, you know, maybe their kidneys aren't working as well, you'll see the creatinine start to build up in the blood. And you'll see that filtration rate go down. But that looks pretty good. Sometimes when somebody's done like a really heavy, intense exercise and they go and get their blood work done, or maybe they did the exercise the day before because of the muscle breakdown, that creatinine might be a little falsely elevated and might look like their kidney function is affected, which is why I always say if you're going to do a CMP like this, fasting, don't exercise or do like some hardcore weightlifting the day of or even the day before.
And make sure you drink some water
Yeah,
before you
stay
go.
hydrated.
Yeah.
And then, of course, our electrolytes, sodium, potassium, chloride, carbon dioxide, great. Most of the time, most people have pretty good indices on that. If somebody did drink a ton of water, which I've seen to stay hydrated for their blood draw, their sodium might look a little falsely low,
Right.
falsely
Right,
low.
right.
You just don't really want, you don't want it to be super low, but you have to take that into consideration because low sodium can cause tetany. Same with potassium. If somebody's taking certain medications, that potassium can be elevated, and that's a cardiovascular risk. So it's just one of those things to kind of have a look at. And then one of my favorite ones to look at is that AST and ALT. Those are your liver enzymes. So every time a liver enzymes, you know, or every time a liver cell dies, it releases these enzymes. So you have a fatty liver, you might have, you know, elevated liver enzymes. If you have hepatitis, they'll be way high. You know, certain medications like acetaminophen or medications that have to go through the liver, you'll have elevated liver enzymes, alcohol. What I find is like high fructose corn syrup. People that drink a lot of soda, they'll have a little, they can have a little burden on that liver.
Yeah, a high fructose corn syrup is literally a bona fide liver toxin. Like it literally is just as bad, if not worse, than alcohol, and maybe even worse than alcohol. So drinking a Coke or a soda and drinking you know, whiskey, it has literally the same effect on the liver. So you know, even though you might not drink alcohol necessarily, if you're having high fructose corn syrup on a regular basis, you are literally damaging your liver, causing fatty liver. That's, it's a big spiral that can really, cause some problems. So your numbers are great, nice and low. That's, again, across the board, you know, straight A's on your, CMP.
Later, we'll circle back to that liver. There's a couple of different indices on that, but we'll go one by one on here. And look, I have high cholesterol,
Yeah. Well,
which we'll circle back to that too. But
yeah.
the total cholesterol 193, Great. Triglycerides, I find, have a little bit more with carbohydrate or sugar intake. So having that under 100 is good. And I'm not a big sweet tooth person. But the HDLs, high density lipoproteins, so the higher the better. That's the beneficial cholesterol. So the 72, I feel, is pretty good. Most women tend to have pretty good HDLs. It has to do with our estrogen. And then you have the very low density lipoproteins and then the low density lipoproteins, the LDLs. So the lower they say, the better. But every single cell in our body is encapsulated by a lipid membrane. So we need cholesterol. I wouldn't say 111 is high because back in September of 2016, they changed the reference ranges for cholesterol from 130 to
30.
now like 99. So it's putting me at technically high LDLs. I don't think it is, but like I said, later in when we go over these blood tests, I'll circle back around and we'll explain a little bit more with that.
Yeah, kind of differentiating, this number if it's a problem or not. Hemoglobin A1C is great, 5.0.
Forgot the pregnenolone.
Oh,
That's my
sorry. Oh,
favorite.
sorry. Yeah, pregnenolone, of course, that's one that we do a lot. An adrenal hormone, good for the brain, good for memory. If you're stressed, consistently stressed, that number is going to be on the lower side. A 128 is a pretty good number, just in general.
And they have this ridiculous reference range, like normal, anything one under 151. Quest has it from like 22 to 257 or something like that. They have these huge ranges, but pregnenolone is synthesized from the adrenals. You make a little bit in our brain and our spinal cord. I mean, just a little bit, but it does, for me, represent kind of somebody's adrenal health. And pregnenolone is really good for your memory. It helps you put the information into your brain. Like when you were in college and you never had to take notes, or you didn't, I remember you in college, you would just sit there and listen and you could retain everything. Your pregnenolone was probably out of this world. I always had to write it, say it, read it. That was just me. But I will say, I like to see the pregnenolone at least at 80. 80 to like 120 is like kind of like my perfect little spot. But when Dr. Mackey did his blood work, his pregnenolone was kind of
Mine
low.
was less than, mine said less than 10.
Oh,
I mean, yeah, mine wasn't very good at all.
we need to go do some self-care. You need to go get a massage or something.
So yeah, ours are like opposite ends. Yours is really good and mine is,
Well, I do
in
supplement. So I will say for full transparency, I take 30 milligrams of pregnenolone
yeah, that's why your number, that's what you're looking for from that kind of supplementation.
And
Oh,
I love
sorry.
my pregnenolone. I know when I like to take it in the morning. I know that it gives me a little bit more of that mental edge, that mental clarity, that thinking, being able to pivot. Maybe that's why I talk so fast. No, I talk so fast because my mother, my mom, she talks so fast.
Yeah. Okay. So we already touched on the hemoglobin A1C. So blood sugar 73, hemoglobin A1C 5.0. Those two numbers, kind of mix together. When your blood glucose is going up and down and up and down and up and down, that's what pushes up this number over, let's say, a 90-day period of time, right? So the more fluctuation you have in your glucose, the higher this hemoglobin A1C is going to be over time. So you don't have a lot of fluctuation in your hemoglobin A1C. That's
No,
pretty
and
amazing.
yeah, usually it kind of represents the last 4 months. So when I've done hemoglobin A1Cs with people like, in February, it might, even though their blood sugar is good, their hemoglobin A1C might look a little bit on a t the touch high. And then we'll say,
From
well,
the holidays.
the holidays, because it's reflecting a few months back. But don't, put all your weight in gold on the hemoglobin A1C. It's all putting it all together, because I know some people get really worried about their hemoglobin A1C. And when we went to school, I think like 5.9 was normal, or 6 was normal.
Anything below 6 was normal. Anything in the 6s was considered problematic. So they've really reduced that range. But also too, you're so making the connection. Glucose 73, triglycerides 52, hemoglobin A1C at 5.0. Triglycerides are directly correlated to insulin status. So to have a triglyceride of 52, then that someone's insulin status is actually very good. So
What's that equation that you do? You have this great equation.
So you take the triglyceride number right here, so 52, and you divide that by the HDL, which your HDL is 72.
72.
Right,
So
so what's your ratio?
that is 0.7222222.
So 0.72, you want that ratio to be less than 1.5, and you're half of that, it's 0.72. So that's because your triglycerides are low and you can just tell by looking at it, your HDL is higher than your triglycerides are. That is basically an indication that you're not insulin resistant. The higher that ratio is, if you're greater than 1.5, if you're at, I've seen people at 3.5, 4.5,
And what does
6.5,
it mean if the ratio is higher?
you're insulin
So
resistant.
you're at more risk for insulin resistance, meaning you're more risk for diabetes type
Yeah, so
2.
if you're insulin resistant, diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's, cancer, fatty liver, I mean, we could probably put PCOS on there. I mean, there's a whole litany of conditions that are related to insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is a, I've always had this, this thing about insulin, because I think it's a really important hormone. And I think finally now in the 21st century, in 2025, the last few years, especially with YouTube and social media, people have been really talking a lot. One of my favorite scientists at BYU, Dr. Ben Bickman, all he does is study insulin in his lab, and he has sort of validated and confirmed some of my suspicions from a real, research standpoint. And he even talks about why is it not really focused on very much. Partially because I don't think there's really a lot of medications that can manipulate it very well. But when you have good glucose, low triglycerides, a good hemoglobin A1C, even if you didn't have an insulin number, you could infer that your insulin's actually pretty good. And your insulin is perfect. Your insulin's, I think, is less than two.
Yeah, well, yeah, that'll show up a
Well,
little bit later
which is
down there.
incredible. So luteinizing hormone FSH and estradiol at 161.
So the luteinizing hormone and the follicle stimulating hormone, those are signals from the pituitary. It's basically kind of what you would consider your hypothalamus, pituitary, and ovarian axis. So it's how the brain is interacting with the hormones. Now, I'm 52 years old. I'm in menopause. My ovaries are not producing hormones. But my brain thinks it is because I'm doing hormone replacement. So I'm doing a type of hormone replacement, which is the rhythmic dosing. So I'm recreating the ovarian cycle where I'm changing my estradiol throughout the entire cycle. I have an estradiol peak at 12, which we'll go over a little bit later. And then I have a progesterone peak on day 21, but they're all changing. It's not cycling your hormones. It's basically a rhythmic cycling. So you are recreating that ovarian cycle. In that case, when I got this done, I think it was on like it wasn't on day 12 because it just happened to be just a day ago that I went in. I think it might have been like day 5 or 6. But you can see that my FSH and LH are representing that my estradiol is high enough throughout my cycle, as opposed to somebody that was on static dosing. If this somebody was on static dosing and they had this, I would be concerned because the estradiol is too high for somebody taking the same amount of estrogen every single day, 24/7. And then somebody that's on a static dosing, if I saw an FSH and an LH a little on the lower end like this, I might be concerned that their estrogen is a little too high for
Yeah.
their system long term.
Yeah. And eventually, a number like that, if you're on static dosing, 161, it might cause them to have some bleeding at some point. The endometrial lining is going to thicken, and they might, I know, spotting or bleeding in a case like that is actually a good thing, because now it gives you some awareness that,
But you don't want someone static
you don't
bleeding.
want them to, but if
No,
they
no, no.
do, it gives the practitioner some awareness that the dosing needs to be adjusted.
Yeah.
So we'll show a contrast between your estradiol in January and then your estadiol from a
But
couple
this, like I
weeks ago.
said, was I think it was like day 6. It might have been like day 5 or 6. It just was the only time I could get to the lab.
Yeah. Okay. So DHA sulfate, testosterone, and a vitamin D.
So the DHEA and testosterone, those are the androgens. DHEA is secreted are made or synthesized from the adrenal glands mainly, and in the peripheral tissues, it will convert to testosterone. Now, we do make about maybe like 15% of our testosterone from our ovaries. So you go through menopause, that stops, but we're still going to be making testosterone through that conversion of DHEA converting to testosterone. Now, I know my DHEA is high, and they change these reference ranges. You know,
Based on
If
age.
I was 35, that would probably be in a normal range, but I'm at 52. It says it's too high. But I will say I do not take DHEA. I do not take testosterone replacement. I've always had higher androgens. My mother's had higher androgens. I remember when I tested her, I think she must have been, because she's 75,
So 76.
76 right now. I think I tested her when she was like 60, and her testosterone was high and her DHEA, even at 60. So, but this is nice for me to look at because I know I run a little higher. Now, somebody else, if they were supplementing, that might be too high and they'd have androgen symptoms. But
Yeah,
I'm
that's your
testing
endogenous
normal.
production, but that's actually a really good, both of those are really good longevity markers. You want those numbers to be propped up. We don't want the DHA to be declining over time, just because we're getting another year older or another decade older. As the reference range change, it does sort of do that, but the point of hormone replacement and everything that we're doing is trying to get that to not do that. So having those high number norm, I mean, usually for testosterone, a woman, testosterone is going to be, 15 to 25 in years on your own. You're not using any testosterone. Yours is at 43.
Yeah,
That's
so
really good.
down the road, let's say I tested it, because I do consider that a little bit more of an adrenal hormone for us females, because DHEA made from the adrenals converting to testosterone is, let's say it dropped in half and I felt, tired and sluggish and maybe not sleeping well, I would know that probably, my adrenals have need a little bit of some TLC. So that, and for example, I have a patient yesterday, no, yeah, it was or last week, and her testosterone, I do have her on testosterone as a transdermal cream.
How many milligrams?
Oh gosh, I think I have her on 3 milligrams in the morning and 3 milligrams in the evening. And her testosterone level is 70.
That's a pretty good amount.
No, she loves
That's
it.
pretty good.
Her testosterone is 70. Her hair is good. She doesn't get any pimples or any breakouts. And her libido is great. I mean, really good, like very responsive. And that works for her. But I had another patient about a month ago, and her testosterone, because I think I have her on, it wasn't very much, like maybe 1.5 milligrams of testosterone in the morning, 1.5 milligrams of testosterone in the evening. Her testosterone ended up being 70, and she doesn't feel good. I mean, she's in her 60s. She's breaking out. She feels crabby and testy.
So again, that androgen tolerance, she's a little bit more sensitive, same number, but one's sensitive and one's responding well.
So I adjusted that. So because 70 is too high for her, so we'll bring that back down to probably about 33, 30 to 35, and that'll probably be fine for her. Where the other gal I just saw, 70 is great for her. So that's where I do feel like sometimes with the androgens, when you're replacing them, it really is suited towards the individual.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And then my vitamin D is too high. It's
Taking a
too
little,
high.
taking a little too much. It was January though.
I remember I was, because I do these this liquid vitamin D 3 with K2. I remember doing extra because so many people were sick, and I was having psychosomatic symptoms, like I think my throat's sore. I think I've got a sore throat or something. So I was doing extra vitamin D. So I'll be checking that at some point to make sure it
Since
don't.
since 2020 though, I don't know how many of these high levels I've seen. I think everybody, the highest one I've seen so far is like 240 something. Someone was taking a whole lot. Again, liquid, just squirting it in there. The liquid's good, but you got to be careful because it's 1,000 IUs per drop on most of the liquids. So, you take that whole dropper full on a daily basis and you're going to have a really high number.
You'll do what I
Yeah. Now
did.
it is a, so people need to be aware, it is a fat soluble vitamin, so it can build up, and you can become, hypervitaminosis from vitamin D. Now I've never seen that before. You've never seen that before. I'm not sure even what it looks like as far as symptoms. Probably more than likely people would start having some bone pain or some, muscle or joint pain
Maybe
of some sort.
some kidney
I know that can
issue.
happen with, if you take a vitamin A or even like Accutane, which is
Oh,
synthetic
yeah.
vitamin A. But yeah, just at that point, if someone's got a number like that, either maintain the dosage but just decrease the frequency, or decrease the dose and then the number drops off. That number I think should be vitamin D like somewhere between 60 and 80. It doesn't need to be over 100. Okay, so GGT, another liver enzyme, sed rate, progesterone, and there's your insulin.
So the GGT, what that relates to that AST and ALT on that comprehensive metabolic panel looking at liver damage. So, but the GGT is more acute liver damage. Like, is there being damage to my liver right this
Right.
moment? And
Yeah. So those
we're
liver
good.
enzymes are supposed to be inside your liver cells. So if the liver cells are being damaged, either because of a virus or a disease process, now those cells die. The liver enzymes go into your blood and it increases the concentration. And then you show it up. You show up. There's always turnover. Those cells are always turning over. So there's a certain amount that's supposed to be in your blood. But if too many cells are dying, like you said, acutely or just in general, now that concentration goes up and it can indicate that there's a problem going on. And usually at that point, if it continues or it continues to rise, Or those AST and ALT numbers. Usually fatty liver is a very common thing for perimenopausal women. And at that point, you'd probably want to get an ultrasound, a liver ultrasound done just to see what's going on
Yeah,
there.
just to figure out, like I had a patient the other week and her liver enzymes, AST and ALT, were elevated. She doesn't drink alcohol. She doesn't drink a soda pop or, she doesn't take Tylenol or any medications, but she was doing a lot of liver detoxification process. She was taking all this sort of protocol to detox metals, to detox parasites, you name it. She was trying to detox it. And it was causing her AST and ALT to go up. So I said, let's. Your liver's been, in the ring fighting, detoxing for you, doing this, this protocol she was doing. I wasn't doing it with her, but when I saw her liver enzymes, I'm like, I know she doesn't drink. What's going on here? Like, what's happening? But she told me about what she was taking, and I said, let's stop that liver detox. You've been doing. She was doing it for like 3 months, and I said, stop that, and then let's just support your liver. And then I didn't do a GGT on her, which I'm going to do coming up soon, so I can make sure that that looks good and that the AST and ALT are going down. So it can come down for all right. That can go up from lots of different issues, like I said, even supplements.
It's very, very sensitive, more sensitive than the other two in some respects. The AST and ALT, very common. They're run all the time. Certain medications can cause them to go up, like I said, supplementation, in a detox situation. High fructose corn syrup, what we talked about, can make them rise. So now your progesterone, maybe explain what's going on there with your
Real
progesterone.
quick, we'll do the sed rate. So sed rate is looking at inflammation, but all over inflammation. It's not anything that's specific. And I'll circle back to that when we look at some other indices that are more specific. But let's say somebody had a cold or a flu, their sed rate could be elevated. Let's say they fell down and like twisted their ankle, their sed rate would be elevated. If they had osteoarthritis, the sed rate could be elevated. Having an autoimmune condition like a connective tissue autoimmune issue, that can raise up the sed rate. So I like to check a sed rate every once in a while just to see if there's any kind of inflammation in the system that we're not picking up. It's like I said, it's very vague, but it's a really quick and cheap test that you can look at to just kind of give you an overall view of inflammation. But the progesterone, because I'm on, like I said, that rhythmic dosing where I'm taking the estrogen and progesterone and that of what the ovaries would secrete, it literally mimics ovarian function like nature intended, is I did this in my follicular phase of my cycle before, because I don't take my progesterone until day 14. So progesterone at 0.3 is exactly where it should be because I wasn't taking it at that time.
So a woman's body, excuse me. So a woman's body, in when they're normally menstruating on their own, a woman's body doesn't produce any progesterone until they ovulate. So roughly day 14 is when progesterone production starts to go up. So days from day one of your period to day roughly 13, which is where you were dosing here, there's no progesterone at all. That's quite a bit different than static dosing, where women are encouraged to take their progesterone every day, all the time. So insulin, we talked about that, right? The little triad, gl blood glucose, triglycerides, hemoglobin A1C, all perfect. And as a result, your insulin, or the other part of that is your insulin is nice and low. A lot of doctors don't test insulin. I think insulin, I'm a little biased, but I think insulin is a very, very important test. Once you start getting into the reference range over here, if you can see this or not, 2.6 to 24.9, I think that's in a tremendously wide reference range. I think once people get into the double digits above 10, they're already kind of in that insulin resistant phase for the most part.
And I know it says low, but you think about the mechanism of action on what insulin is supposed to do. So if I'm fasting and I haven't eaten anything, I shouldn't really have any insulin in my system. But let's say I ate a cookie or a pancake or something that's, sweet with some carbohydrates, even an apple or some fruit or a peach. Is that glucose, I eat it, it gets digested, the blood sugar rises, the glucose goes up in my bloodstream, and then the pancreas notices that and it secretes insulin, and insulin unlocks the door to the cell to allow the glucose to go up. So somebody with a diabetes type 1, they're not making any insulin, which is why they have their glu they don't even know their glucose might be at 400 because that insulin isn't being secreted from the pancreas to allow that glucose to go in there. So when we do a fasting insulin, and let's say someone's insulin's at 17 or 19, you're thinking, why in the world, if you haven't eaten anything, is your insulin elevated?
Sure. Yeah. Because when someone's
Or even present, right?
insulin, when someone,
Sorry, the dog.
the dog is,
She's pushing the camera.
she's rolling all on the floor. So when insulin is elevated or because of dietary choices, the high fructose corn syrup, even though that doesn't directly raise glucose, fructose is a little different, but on the back end, through the liver, it creates more insulin resistance. When that insulin is high, it creates more insulin. The pancreas tries to compensate. So you're putting insulin on top of insulin to compensate. And then the cells in the body, the liver cells and all the other peripheral cells, that's why people get neuropathy in their feet. Eventually having dementia and Alzheimer problems because the peripheral cells in the body are not responding or able to utilize glucose very well. Because their body is sort of desensitized or resistant to the insulin that's there. So the way the body compensates is produces more and more and more. And you see a fasting insulin that's, we've seen them as high as what, 20, 30,
40.
50, 60. I mean, we've seen some
What was my dad's? So
like a
this was like a
like 15 years ago, it was like 46. It was like 46 point something, but he wasn't technically a diabetic yet because his blood glucose was still under 100.
and you say yet
Yeah, yet.
because he became
Because it took
diabetic.
another couple of years before he got an actual diagnosis. But an insulin level, a fasting insulin of 46, is basically what they used to call occult diabetes. Basically, it's already diabetes that hasn't been diagnosed yet because I think they're using the wrong parameter to, they're using just blood glucose and maybe a hemoglobin A1C to diagnose that when they really should be looking at someone's insulin level. So, if you haven't had an insulin level done, we encourage everyone to have it done at least once a year or something just to see where that number is.
And do it fasting.
Yeah, and
Do
do it,
it
yeah, and do it
fasting.
fasting. I mean, you could do it after a meal or something, but to see how high it goes. But like even a glucose tolerance test, they do that for pregnant women, but they don't test the insulin. They just test blood sugar. If you're going to do a glucose tolerance test, you should be doing a fasting insulin and a fasting blood sugar, and then a glucose and an insulin at the same time, so you can see how high that insulin goes in response to the sugary stuff they give you, or if you're eating a meal, because it's the rise and fall of the insulin, of the blood sugar, and therefore the insulin that creates the resistance over time. So what we want from our meals is like these nice little ebbs and flows to our blood sugar, as opposed to these huge peaks and valleys.
That's interesting because I just had a patient and she runs a little high on her hemoglobin A1C, but she's got her blood sugar is great. It's excellent in the 70s and her she's fit, very fit, and she actually teaches nutrition. And her I told I had her do the blood work. She didn't do it fasting. Her blood sugar was still under 100 and her insulin was like 17.9, but her hemoglobin A1C was like 6. So it was kind of interesting, but she had eaten breakfast that morning.
How long from breakfast to the test?
I think she said like 3 hours. It wasn't that long because when I looked at the test, it was like at 11 and she had eaten breakfast before that.
So you'd figure, so you eat a meal, your blood sugar goes up, your insulin's going to go up. I think
It
it's,
should have been 4 hours
I think a
after.
normal response, I have to look this up. I don't remember off the top of my head. Dr. Binkman would know for sure. But when we eat a meal, a normal rise to our insulin postprandial after a meal, yeah, I think is like, 40 to 60 or something
Hers
like
was
that.
really low
All
then.
right. But see, within a 3 hour window, it's supposed to go up and then it's
And
supposed to
then
come
come
back
back.
down. So hers is on the way back down. 17, within another probably an hour or two, her number would have been below 10
Yeah.
and it would have been back into the normal range because it's supposed to go up and go down. When someone's insulin resistant, you look at their blood sugars over time, their blood sugars are delayed. You're supposed to have this nice rise and fall. Because that insulin resistance is in place for years and years and years, their blood sugars, they go up and then they stay elevated for a very long time. And instead of it coming down in 3 hours like it's supposed to, it might not come down for 6 hours. So if you think about American lifestyle, we have carbs for breakfast, carbs for lunch, carbs for snacks, carbs for dinner, carbs all day long. You're putting carbs on tops of carbs on top of carbs. You're never giving your blood sugar and insulin a chance to sort of come back to normal. And then that process over time is what makes that insulin go up over time. And then as a result, not a cause, but a result, then the blood sugar starts to rise. A good indicator of insulin resistance, besides these lab values, is hypertension. Someone's got hypertension's on medication that they have a insulin resistance problem. Okay, so now I'm going to close this one out, and now we're going to switch to another one. So bear with me a second as I kind of fumble around here. I can sort of figure this out. Okay, let's go like this. So now we're going to share the other one. Okay, so this is the new one. Okay, so hopefully I did that right. Hopefully that wasn't too painful
Yep,
for
that
everybody.
looks right.
Okay, so this is so these are in different order than the other ones. So these are from literally about 7 days ago.
I was on day 12 of my rhythmic dosing, which is when the estradiol is the highest. So you can see it was at 407. It was at 400.
Yeah. So your other one was the beginning of the cycle. Now you're at a lower dosing at that point, was 161. This was on day 12, and your number was 407.
407.
Now that would sort of freak some people out because that number is so high. But let's just scroll down a little bit. I put a picture in here. This picture right here is what a woman on rhythmic dosing is basically trying to copy. So this little pink, color, whatever this color is right here, this is the estrogen. And right here is the ovulation peak. So basically, day 14 on average is where most women are going to ovulate. So right here is day 12. You can see it doesn't quite exactly line up, but it's pretty darn close. This is looks like more like day 13, but day 12 is where we have most women test when they're doing rhythmic dosing because that's the peak of estradiol. So you were tested over here. You said it was like day 5 or 6.
Yeah,
So you.
few times I ended up having to get it, in the
Yeah, so
beginning
you were
part.
just on the rise over here back in January, and then you made a couple of dosing adjustments, and now here you are at 4 or 6. Now, our target on day 12 with rhythmic dosing is relatively between 300 to 350, maybe a little bit broad, maybe 250 to 350. Okay, so technically your number is a little bit higher than it needs to be.
It's a little higher. I did do it. Let's see, I got the blood draw at 9:30, right? And I remember counting it out that it was about 4.5 hours after I had applied the cream, because 7, it was, because I wake up at 5. But then, so I think when I ended up planning it, so let's say somebody put it on, it was 2 hours later, that level could be a little falsely elevated.
Yeah.
Let's
If
say
you did
they.
it too, if you did the cream, applied the cream and went to the lab too quick, that number could be pushed up a little
But
bit.
I know mine was pretty accurate, so it probably is a little bit higher. I'm going to be doing my blood draw again, hopefully tomorrow. We can get it worked out, but and then I'll be able to see where some of those levels. But one thing is, when I'm for me, and I know I'm not for everybody, but I do like to just have a glance at that follicle stimulating hormone, that FSH, to see where
So
that
let's go back up to that.
and that was I think 26. So that is showing that the brain is realizing that there is, hormones in the system. So that, so I do feel like, that's pretty good. I may, and I don't have any symptoms, but I may, just because I like to experiment, maybe back that down or change that up. That way we can kind of, let people know what's going on. Because I do think when we're treating people, for hormones, I like to know what's going on. So I kind of make myself a little bit of a guinea pig.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think a lot of practitioners, we're tr always trying to biohack ourselves, just in general. So 407 doesn't need to be any higher. Maybe not reducing or changing dosing right now. I suggest that I suggested that you wait
Maybe another cycle.
another cycle just to see how it changes. But now the labs you're going to potentially get tomorrow is right here on day 21. So you did this one back in January.
Oh,
Uh,
sorry.
are just uh, uh seven
Last week.
seven days ago, and now here it is on day 21 of your cycle to see what this number is, and you can see this estrogen number starts to come down, right? So that number right here should be maybe not quite half, but somewhere between 150 and 200 on day 21.
So
Some.
we'll see, because I'll do the same amount of time of when I applied the cream to when I, to when I test.
Yeah. That's kind of in a nutshell. This is
You did do the thyroid. You did put the thyroid on there, right?
I did not.
Or just the re Okay, maybe we'll do that
Yeah,
a different
yeah,
time.
yeah.
Okay, we'll do that a different
I
time.
forgot to put the thyroid numbers on there. So here's the So we are talking on the last ones we did in January. We were talking about your LDL was at 111. Okay, so the way to sort of differentiate or drill a little bit deeper is to do an ApoB, and your ApoB honestly looks pretty darn good.
Yeah, so the apolipoprotein B is, I think, a little bit more specific if you're going to get atherosclerosis. So where some, a lot of doctors, a lot of people will look at that cholesterol. Oh my gosh, my cholesterol is so high. I'm going to have atherosclerosis and have a cardiovascular event. I think you want to pair that with the apolipoprotein B because if somebody has a higher ApoB, that means there's more apt that that LDL cholesterol and calcium are going to be seated in the arterial walls, specifically of the heart. What's the Widowmaker and the Grim Reaper?
ALD, the LAD, the left anterior descending artery.
And then the right coronary artery, is that the other one?
Those are the two main ones that have most of the blockages, or that if someone that caused most heart attacks, the Widowmaker, like you said, is the LAD. So if you look at a picture of the heart, either online or in a book or something, the one that comes right down the center of the heart supplies blood to the left ventricle. So if you get a blockage or a heart attack in that LAD, it affects the left ventricle. And the left ventricle is the part of the heart that does all the heavy lifting. When it contracts, it pushes the blood out into the body, and we don't want that to be damaged. The heart, unlike the liver does a good job of healing itself. The heart does not heal itself very well. So when there's damage, it might heal a little bit, but it doesn't heal. Like the liver can practically regenerate itself. Right, you hurt it, damage it, whatever. The liver does a really good job. The heart is a little bit a different type of tissue and doesn't have that capability. But 77 is pretty darn good.
But then, so for females, I think, we always think about heart disease and cardiovascular events with men. But once a female hits menopause, that their risk for heart disease does go up. So I feel like we're a lot of men get these, the Boston Heart Test and has all the apolipoprotein B on there. I think it's important for women to have that done
Of
too.
course, yeah.
That's why I did this so that we could present this to everybody to say, as females, sure, we'd love to talk about hormones, but we also want to talk about female longevity and lifespan. That, let's say your LDL cholesterol is like mine, 110 or even 120.
Sure.
Do the apolipoprotein B to make sure that that's not elevated because that's what you want to focus on. So I do think that that's just as important for women as it is for men.
Yeah, and I wouldn't really, total cholesterol is not really where the focus should be. Total cholesterol doesn't really mean much. If your cholesterol is over 200, I heard someone say the other day, and I haven't looked at this exactly, but they're saying that an ideal total cholesterol is about 225, right? Which is technically elevated. This number, the triglycerides, the HDL, so low triglycerides, high HDL, and a low ApoB, I think that's relatively a pretty good strategy of reducing risk as much as possible.
And I'm not on any supplements for lowering cholesterol like red yeast rice or bergamot or anything like that. So that's why if somebody did have that elevated, there's lots of different supplements that we can do to work on that and even lifestyle. So we'll probably get into that in the future. But I do think also as women, which is we're looking at heart disease, is doing a highly sensitive C-reactive protein, or they also call it a cardiac C-reactive protein. They do that a lot with men because men are more, typically they say, oh, more prone to heart disease. But I do think a CRP cardiac is important for a female to have done, maybe not every time you do a blood work, but definitely, more frequently to watch that inflammation, because that's looking at inflammation in your cardiovascular system.
Yeah, C-reactive protein is made in the liver, but even things like fatty liver disease and other burdens on the liver can make that number go up. And I think unfortunately, it is meant to emulate cardiovascular inflammation, but it's very uns it doesn't diagnose anything. It just tells you, hey, there's a warning, there's a red flag, going on. There's a warning sign that there's too much inflammation. And now the same things that cause that number to go up, that cause the ApoB to go up, that causes insulin resistance, they're all kind of tied together. And like you said, when a woman goes into menopause, they become automatically more insulin resistant, right? So they're doing fine, all of a sudden their female hormones disappear, and they're overnight, maybe they're not sleeping, maybe their dietary choices are not the best. And now if they were a little bit of insulin resistant, now it starts to compound itself and all those things start to shift. That's a good, yours is a really good.
Yeah, no, and I do think it's helpful, especially to see some of these numbers. So, I have a lot of patients in their CRP and they're females, and it's at like, 3.5, 4.5. And I said, okay, well, let's work on this. It's like you said, it's one indice. That's why I also included that SED rate in there. And I like to look at the SED rate, because like I want to see if there's any kind of inflammation going on, because even you can pick up osteoarthritis a little bit with the SED rate. But let's say I had, fell down and, hurt my ankle, or hurt something, or maybe I was got really sick and I got the flu, and my SED rate was elevated. So it was maybe it's at 15, or and I had said, oh yeah, I fell down and hurt my hip, or I have some bursitis or something. Sometimes because the CRP is so sensitive, you can see it falsely elevated, and then people get really scared. They're like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna have a heart attack, or I'm gonna have heart disease. I'm like, wait a minute, wait a minute. It's really sensitive. Did you know what? Your SED rate's a little elevated. Did you injure yourself? Did you have something happen? And they'll say, oh yeah, this had happened. And I'll say, we need to, that one's void. We need to wait till your body's repaired itself, and let's retest it.
Yeah.
So it is, there are false positives or whatnot in this blood work that you always want to kind of take into consideration. So that's why I put that CRP with the SED rate on there, so everybody could see that.
Yeah, another what they call it, an acute phase reactant, another inflammatory marker. You can also use a ferritin level. Ferritin is sort of how we store iron, but it can often be a marker of inflammation as well, especially in men. Men are not supposed to have a high. I'm trying to think of almost like what you said about someone having a an injury or they got the flu or some kind of illness. That ferritin level is going to go up in the short term. See it coming come down. So yeah, SED rate's good. CRP is very good. Let's see what else we got. Oh, and then
I
we're
think that's it.
and we're back to the menstrual cycle.
Yeah, we'll do the thyroid next time because I did do the thyroid dosing, and I think I'm going to do it again tomorrow. So we'll go over kind of, how to read thyroid.
Your numbers actually look pretty good. They've changed a little bit because you modified some dosing, but they look pretty good now. So hopefully that was kind of a down and dirty, but the hormone numbers are put into context when you look at this picture. This picture sort of is why the rhythmic dosing is the way that it is, because we're trying to recreate that picture for the most part. This pink part right here and this green part. Obviously, when a woman's on rhythmic dosing, she's not going to be ovulating, right? I've had quite a few people ask if they're on rhythmic dosing if they can get pregnant, right? Because they're having a period. The husbands are like, "Can she get pregnant?" No,
No, no,
she can't get
no.
pregnant just because you can menstruate without ovulating, but you can't ovulate without menstruating, right? So just because you're having a period and you're 55, doesn't mean that you can get pregnant. That's not possible. So any last final comments about your wonderful blood work?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Nope, this was great. So I hope everybody enjoyed our presentation.
Yeah, have a good day. Take care.
Take
Bye-bye.
care. Bye.